Hi, everybody. My name is Rob Mason. I'm an alcoholic. They told me not to touch the microphone, so like an alcoholic, I'm going to first thing. Kathy said I'm really good at explaining the big book, teaching the big whatever. I'm really good at relapse. I can tell you that. That's one thing I'm really good at. Lots of practice at that. And I want to ask everybody, if you would, to, like we did last week, join me for another moment of silence and a prayer I like to use that one of my sponsors taught me. Lord, help me to set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about my fellows, and everything I think I know about my own recovery, all for a new experience in you, Lord, a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, and a much-needed new experience in my own recovery. Amen. Last week, for those of you who were here, how many were here for last week, by the way? Oh, lots of returning people. I didn't scare you off yet, huh? All right, that's good. That's good. Last week we talked about a little bit about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, how our fellowship came to be, how our book, more importantly, came to be, which we know from last week is the basic text of our society, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more this morning. If everybody can open to the title page, the table of contents of the book, that's where we're going to start. And I just want to say a few words sort of recapping last week. And a couple of things, I want to clear up a couple of things I said last week. I screw one thing up at least every week, okay? That's just the rule. We'll get it out of the way now, okay? Last week, we talked about some recovery rates that are found in the forward to the second edition of our book. And somebody came up to me after the meeting and they said, gosh, boy, I'm really depressed. Our recovery rate today isn't what it was in 1939, and boy, that's really depressing. And I was in such a hurry because I knew we were running over, I forgot to give you the hope. See, typical alcoholic, I forget to give you the hope, right? The hope is, okay, and this is the whole point of last week, was I still have access to a 75% or greater rate of recovery for myself and the people that I work with if I follow the precise directions that are outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Does that make sense to everybody? That was the whole point of last week. And my assertion last week was that the reason that they had a better rate of recovery than we do today, and there are many reasons. I mean, AA is much bigger. There's different people coming to AA now than there were then. Somebody asked me that after the meeting. I agree with that. But I would also say that a major reason that AA was more successful then, and it's not my opinion, okay? You could read the history. Many of the founders of our program felt that AA was more successful then than it is now because the program of recovery has gotten garbled in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. That the program of recovery has gotten watered down over the course of time. Okay? And so that's why we're interested in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I handed out a little handout called the Big Book Goals. And I want to just say that in order to understand our book, we have to first understand the purposes or the goals of the book. Can I have one, by the way? I didn't save one for myself. Can I borrow yours just for a second? Thank you. And it looks something like this, okay? And I want to say that these visual aids are not meant to add or take away from anything that's in the book. They're just a visual representation, okay? And you can do whatever you want with them. You can make paper airplanes, throw it at somebody. I don't care, okay? I'm a visual thinker, and this kind of helps me to understand what's in the book, okay? And you'll notice on this sheet called the Big Book Goals that the first goal of the Big Book is to identify in the far left-hand box on the top what is the problem, okay? And that's what we're going to be talking about primarily today and a little bit next week in Bill's story and the doctor's opinion. That is where they lay out what is my problem. And if you look in that bottom box, step one is a statement of the problem. I am powerless and my life is unmanageable. That's the problem. Anybody disagree with that? Okay, that's the problem, right? That's why we're all here, right? Okay, my problem is I'm powerless and my life is unmanageable. So very naturally, if my problem is powerlessness, my solution is power, right? And that's what the second step talks about, a power greater than myself restoring me to sanity. Okay, so the solution to lack of power is power. Okay, and the second goal of the book, if you look there in the middle of the page, is the solution. If I know what my problem is in the doctor's opinion, where they're going to give me a medical description of my problem, and in Bill's story where they're going to give me a textbook case of the problem the doctor describes in the doctor's opinion, then the next thing I need to know is what is my solution. Okay, and we're going to be discussing that in chapter 2, chapter 3, or at least the last two pages of chapter 3, and all of we agnostics. Okay? So, in other words, the first 60 pages of our book are designed to convince me of two ideas and two ideas only. What is my problem, step one, and what is my solution, step two. And Bill is going to do what I call the 1-2 punch all the way through the first 60 pages in the doctor's opinion. In other words, he's going to, and we're going to start it today when we go through the doctor's opinion, he's going to start by giving us an example of the problem. Step one, bang, powerlessness. He's going to give us an example of it, okay? Then a couple sentences later, he's going to hit us with the solution, the idea of power, okay? Solving our problem. And then a couple of pages later, he's going to go back again and word it differently. Again, another example of the problem, powerlessness, bang. And then he's going to hit us again a couple sentences later with the solution, step two. And he's going to do this all the way through to page 60. Problem, solution, powerlessness, power, problem, solution, step one, step two. And when we get to page 60, he's going to ask us to make a decision. He's going to begin to ask us to make a decision based on our own experience and what we've learned in the first 60 pages. And he's hoping that he can word it in just such a way that by the time we reach page 60, we will have come to accept the idea of step one and come to accept the idea of step two, that we will be able to make a decision in step three. Okay? And the decision that we make in step three, incidentally, okay, is really a decision, do I want to live in the problem? Step one. If I do, then I can go drink. Or do I want to live in the solution? Step two. Okay? If I want to live in the solution, then the third goal of the book is the action necessary for recovery on the far right-hand side. And that's where chapters 5, 6, and 7 come in. That is the program of recovery, the program of action that is going to help me find the power that they talk about in step 2, which is going to solve my problem that we talked about in step 1. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. So that is how our book is laid out. And for someone who's out there wondering, chapters 8, 9, 10, and 11 are all about, now that I've had this spiritual experience, now that I've learn this new way of life, it's all about applying that solution, applying that way of that new way of living, that manner of living in every area of my life, in my job, with my family, with my wife, with my husband, with my kids, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So that's that. We can set that aside. Here you go, young lady. Thank you very much. All right. So our book, we found out last week, is a textbook. And our book is laid out much like many textbooks are laid out, in a principle of cognitive learning called sequential learning. And there's a reason I'm telling you this, okay? Because I thought when I read this it was kind of like a novel. You could take little bits and pieces and take what you wanted and you'd be so inspired, and then you'd put it down and you'd never read it again, right? And when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I wanted to know what to do the last time, they said, well, open to chapter 5 and do what it says, right? And so that's what I did, and there was a lot of stuff that I really didn't understand very well. And what I found out later on was that there's a reason that there's four chapters that come before chapter 5. For example, let's say I go to math class on the first day and I don't know anything about math, and they say open to chapter 5 and try to work the problems there. Am I going to be able to do it? Probably not, right? But if I open to chapter 1 and they teach me the basic principles of math, they teach me how to add and subtract, and then in chapter 2, they teach me how to multiply and divide. And in chapter 3, they teach me decimals. And in chapter 4, they teach me fractions. Then when I get to chapter 5, I will have learned enough based on learning from the previous chapters to be able to do what is mentioned in chapter 5. Does that make sense? Well, our book is laid out the same way. And the entire reason that they put the doctor's opinion first, if you'll open there, because that's where we're going to start, is because the rest of the book is about overcoming the illness that he describes in the doctor's opinion. And we're going to spend the rest of today talking about step one. Incidentally, Bill spends more time talking about step one in the working text than any other step. Okay? It's also the only step he says we can work perfectly. Okay? The other steps he says are ideals. They're measuring sticks by which we estimate our progress. So the only step I have to do perfectly for those of you who are new is step one. Okay, it's the only, and incidentally, step one for me was the hardest step to take, and for many of us it is. You know, for many of us, step one is the hardest step there is, okay? Because there's just something within me that just cries out against the idea of personal powerlessness, right? There is something within me that will rebel against the idea, and I will cling to the notion that somehow, some way, I am going to find a way to successfully drink, right? I'm going to find a way to successfully manage my own life and be the master of my own destiny, right? And I'll tell you, towards the end of my drinking, there were many, many, many times where it was obvious to everyone around me that that was not the case, right? Except for me. Except for the one person that needed to know it, right? And time after time, I went through treatment centers, and time after time, I got out of detox, and time after time, I got out of the hospital, and I said, you know what? I said what Clancy says all the time, you know, my case is different, right? The credo of every alcoholic, my case is different, right? And it really is true, and I really believe that my case is different, right? And I lived that lie for a long, long time. And so some of us never get it. Some people, and you'll see them, I mean, for anybody here who's ever been to a detox, how many people have ever been to a detox meeting here? Either as an inmate or as a volunteer, right? Yeah, I've been on both sides of that, right? I did a meeting for 4 years down at the Salvation Army, a couple miles up the road here, you know? And you know, these guys, right, they're one step from Skid Row. One step from Skid Row, but they'll tell you they've got it all together, right? And I understand that. I understand that because that's exactly how I was, you know? And I believed it. That's the worst part, right? I'm killing myself, but I believe it. All right. So, I want to say a couple things about the doctor's opinion real quickly before we get started here. First thing, notice it's called the doctor's opinion, right? Pretty obvious, right? Why is it called the doctor's opinion? Because in 1939, when they wrote the book, they did not know that this was factual or not. Dr. Silkworth, okay, who wrote our book, Dr. William D. Silkworth, M.D., was a neuropsychiatrist, right? And he got to work with alcoholics kind of on accident. He really didn't set out to work with alcoholics, but he, in the Depression, you know, you did what you had to do, kind of like we're doing today a little bit, right? Some of us, right? And so he ended up working with alcoholics at Towns Hospital. He became the physician-in-chief at Towns Hospital. He worked with over 50,000 alcoholics in his career, okay? And so over the course of time, if you work with 50,000 of anything, I don't care what it is, right? Tires, hats. You're going to start to develop some theories about what it is you're working with. And so based on his observation, rather than scientific research, he developed this theory, okay? And we're going to talk about his theory here. He believed we had a twofold illness, okay? And we're going to talk about that as we get into the doctor's opinion, okay? Now, today we know that everything that he put in the doctor's opinion, that his theory was absolutely sound. In 1956, the AMA and the American Psychiatric Association confirmed what Dr. Silkworth believed, that alcoholism is an illness of the mind and the body. Okay? But we did not know that in 1939. Okay? In 1939, this was very controversial stuff that he put in here. Okay? And that's why when he originally wrote this, he left his name out. Okay? Because he was concerned about his reputation. The second thing is, if you look at the bottom of the doctor's opinion, you'll notice some little tiny Roman numerals down there. Everybody see that? Okay? Circle those Roman numerals if you haven't already. Okay? Now, if you get a copy of the first edition, anybody have a copy of the first edition here? I have one at home, but I don't have one here. If you look in the first edition, you'll see that it appeared on page 1. Okay? In our book, Bill's story appears on page 1. Okay? Now, why is that important? Because when they reprinted it for the second edition, somebody at New York got the idea, and I'm not arguing saying it's right or wrong, it is what it is, that because the doctor's opinion was not written by an alcoholic, it should be moved to the Roman numeral section, okay, and Bill's story should start on page 1. Now, why is that important? Because it changed the use of the doctor's opinion in the fellowship, okay? I've actually had discussion, passionate discussion, I'll call it, with some people that will tell you that the doctor's opinion is not part of the text of the book. Okay? Because when I start reading a book, I don't start with the Roman numerals, do you? I start on page 1, right? That's the kind of guy I am, right? And because it changed the use of the doctor's opinion in the fellowship, some people just breeze right over it. What they don't understand is that the doctor's opinion is the foundation of the book. Because as I said earlier, the rest of the book is all about overcoming the illness that he's going to describe right here in these next few pages. Okay? All right, so I'm going to ask some questions during this workshop. If you know the answer, just go ahead and shout it right out. So based on what we learned last week, for those of you who were here. Where is the program of recovery found? Is it found in the fellowship or is it found in the book? Okay, well, let's see what it says right here. Okay, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described where? In this book, right? Not a plan of recovery, not one plan of recovery. No, it says the plan of recovery described in this book. Okay, so if I want to find the plan of recovery, I'm going to find it where? In the book, right? Now, I want to say a little footnote to this. Anybody else here besides me a planner? I'm a planner. I'm a kind of a planning kind of guy. And I remember every time I would go to detox, I would start planning. You know what I mean? I would plan what I was... Every time I went to a 30-day treatment center, I would start planning stuff right away, you know? And I'd plan on getting out and where I was going to live, and I was going to get a job, and I was going to be the kind of son I should be, and I was going to pay back those people I owed that money, and I wasn't going to go to those places I shouldn't go anymore. Anybody here ever done that? Yeah, yeah. And what I didn't realize, and I remember that we used to get these guys that would come in. Back in those days, they called it H&I. Maybe they still do. They would come in to the detox, or they'd come into the treatment center, and they'd bring meetings in from the outside, right? And I don't know what it was, but I really thought that you AA people were really interested in all my plans that I had, what I was going to do when I got out, you know? And so I would kind of share these plans, you know, and these people would just kind of look at me, you know, because they knew I was kidding myself, right? And I'll tell you, I never accomplished not one of those plans. You know why? Because usually there was between me and that plan was a liquor store somewhere along the way as soon as I got out, right? And what I found out later on was as long as I had a plan, I was unable to accept the plan of recovery outlined in this book. See? The last time I got out of detox, the last time I got out of treatment, okay, all my plans were done. I didn't have a plan. I didn't know what to do, right? And what I didn't realize is that for me was the key to take the first step. That for me was the key to be able to really apply the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I was using my program, not the program of AA. All right. Next paragraph down. It says, to whom it may concern, and this is the doctor writing now, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of the type I had come to regard as hopeless. Everybody circle that word. Important word. Keep your finger there and turn to page 43. Page 43. Second paragraph down. Many doctors and psychiatrists agree, everybody with me, with our conclusions. One of these men, staff member at a world-renowned hospital, recently made this statement to some of us. What you say about the general hopelessness of an alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As to two of you men whose stories I've heard, there's no doubt in my mind that you were 100% hopeless apart from divine help. Kind of interesting. Notice that he doesn't say difficult case, right? He doesn't say slim chance of recovery, does he, right? No, he says hopeless, right? That's a pretty powerful word for a doctor to use, because let me tell you something. Doctors, the one thing they don't want to tell you, even if you are hopeless, is that you're hopeless. Really, you know? That's the one thing they don't want to tell you, because they want to give you some thread of hope to hold on to, right? But here's a doctor who's treated thousands of alcoholics, right? And he's saying that in his estimation, alcoholics of our type, of my type, of Bill's type, and that's who he's talking about here, late 1934, are hopeless. Why? Because not only did Bill, imagine if you were a doctor and you had a guy who was drinking paint, right? And he came in and you'd have to, every once in a while, you'd have to pump his stomach, and you know, and he was just a mess, and he had brain damage. And every time he left, he believed he could drink paint again. But this time he was going to be successful. That must be what it's like for a guy like Dr. Silkworth, who was not an alcoholic himself, to see a guy like Bill. This is, he's going to talk about in the next paragraph, the course of his third treatment. Imagine treating someone for chronic alcoholism who's dying, and yet again and again and again he comes back to the hospital, even though he knows it's killing him, right? And that's why Dr. Silkworth was such an advocate of our program. If you ever read the story of his life, it's fascinating. Okay, is because of his experience with hopelessness. And that's why the first 25,000 people he treated, he had a 2-4% recovery rate by his own admission. Okay, and if you're a doctor and you've given your life to helping other alcoholics, you've given your life to helping people, and you have to deal with their children and their wives and explain to them that, yes, your husband, your wife, your son, your daughter has an illness, and I've tried, I've done everything that I can, and they're probably going to die. Okay, I mean, imagine the feeling that he must have had. And that's why he was such an advocate of Alcoholics Anonymous, because he saw something here that he could not give us. And he's going to talk about that in a couple of more pages. Okay? All right, now, it goes on to say, in the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible... Means of recovery, thank you. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered, right? You remember from last week, we talked about three times we found that same word, didn't we? Right? This is the fourth time. We're going to find it one more time when we get to page 17, right? Where it says nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem, right? You see, I'm not a recovering alcoholic. I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, which means that I no longer have the obsession as a result of the 12 steps. And because I no longer have this obsession, I no longer drink, and the physical allergy does not manifest itself. And we're going to talk about that here in the next page. Next page, right under where it says, "Very truly yours, William D. Silkworth." And I'm not giving you the Roman numeral number because I have a third edition, and I know some of you have a fourth edition, and I don't want to confuse you. All right. And as I said, the big writing is the alcoholics and the small writing is the doctor. So pay close attention to who's saying what here, okay? It says here underneath William D. Silkworth, M.D., "The physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind." And let's stop right there for a minute. You'll remember last week, Dr. Silkworth had developed a... Can you hear me that book right there? Had developed a theory on alcoholism, okay? And he's going to talk about the physical manifestation in the next paragraph, but he talks about the body of the alcoholic and the mind of the alcoholic, okay? And I said last week that when he talks about the body of the alcoholic, he's talking about the allergy of the body, okay? This idea that I have an allergic reaction that he's going to start talking about to alcohol, okay? But unlike some allergies, I don't break out in hives, or I don't get, you know, my tongue doesn't get dust bumps on it, okay? I break out in what he's going to call a phenomena of craving, okay? And then coupled with that, he talks about the mind, that the mind of the alcoholic is different. And I said last week, and I'll say it again, that when he talks about the mind of the alcoholic, he's talking about the obsession of the mind, okay? This idea that somehow things are going to be different next time, right? It goes on to say, "It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or that we were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us." That's where "some are sicker than others" comes from, by the way. Right there, okay? "But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well," okay? And this is where the whole trouble starts in alcoholism, because please remember that up until this point, alcoholism was, there were two schools of thought on alcoholism. The schools of thought in alcoholism has progressed a lot today, so that when you go to a doctor, when you go to the judge or whoever, they send you to AA, right? Most of the time, right? That's where they send you. But back then, there were really two schools of thought, and to some degree that's still true today. You had the physical health people. And the physical health, the internal medicine people believed that alcoholism was some sort of enzyme imbalance, okay, similar to diabetes, and that if they could just find a way to get your enzymes right, give you a pill like insulin, okay, that they could overcome it, Okay? And the focus of most of their treatments, and still sometimes today, is if we could just get these people detoxed from alcohol, right? I mean, because logically, if you think about it, if you're detoxed from something that's killing you, why would you possibly go back to it, right? Logically, that makes sense to a non-alcoholic, right? And so, and we know that doesn't work, don't we, right? Because if that worked, detox would turn out winners, wouldn't they, right? 30-day treatment centers would turn out winners, but they don't, you know. I've been to detox half a dozen times, okay? And you get detoxed, and then you leave, but and we know Dr. Bob's experience. Dr. Bob went to 6 dry out farms, right, and was unsuccessful at staying sober. Then you had the mental health people, and the mental health people believed that if you could just get these wacky alcoholics to understand they cannot drink normally, if you just explain, if they understood the nature of their problem, they really understood it, right, then they wouldn't drink. And logically, that makes sense too, doesn't it? Okay, if you're a non-alcoholic, that if you understand that something's killing you, if you understand you can't do it, why would you possibly go back to it, right? But we talked about last week the experience of Roland Hazard, who went and spent a year in intensive psychotherapy with Dr. Carl Jung, right? And he was drunk before he got back on the boat to go back to the United States, wasn't he, right? So Dr. Silkworth realized that there had to be something else, that there had to be some other thing that had to happen for these alcoholics to stay sober. And he's going to start talking about that here in a couple of pages, okay? So, I want to read you something here from AA Comes of Age that talks about Silkworth's, and you can, this is from page 13 if you want to reference it later, but he talks about in more detail this concept, this opinion, this theory that he developed on alcoholism. And it says, William D. Silkworth, the physician in chief of Charles B. Towns Hospital, a man who was very much a founder of AA. From him we learned the nature of our illness. He supplied us with the tools with which to puncture the toughest alcoholic ego, those shattering phrases by which he described our illness, the obsession of the mind that compels us to drink, and the allergy of the body that condemns us to go mad or die. Right? So he's talking about the allergy, and he's talking about the obsession. All right, next paragraph down in the doctor's opinion. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy, everybody circle the word allergy, we're coming back to it, to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may of course mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account, right? When we get to Bill's story, we're going to come back to that line. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. You know, Bill went to the hospital. He was actually 3 treatments in Towns Hospital. And he says during one of his visits, when we get to page 6 or 7, I believe it is, he says that my incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained, right? Because he understood for the first time, he met Dr. Silkworth, and Silkworth explained to him, Bill, the reason you drink is not because you want to. The reason you drink is because you have an allergy to alcohol, and once you start, you cannot stop, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. Allergy. You know, I thought I knew what an allergy was when I came here. If you don't already have this written down from another workshop, an allergy is an abnormal reaction to any food, beverage, or substance. An abnormal reaction to any food, beverage, or substance. I explained that to a guy I sponsored one time, and he asked me if he took Benadryl, could he drink safely? Now, only an alcoholic would say that, right? I had another guy say to me, well, how can I have an allergy to alcohol? I'm drinking 2 quarts a day, you know? Yeah, yeah. So what is abnormal? What's an abnormal reaction? Well, if the majority of people have one reaction and the minority of people have another reaction, those in the minority are abnormal, right? That makes sense, right? And people have allergies to many things. Some people are allergic to strawberries. Some people are allergic to milk. Some people are allergic to various medications. Some people, you give them a shot of penicillin, they just drop dead. You know, that doesn't happen to me, thankfully. You know, I have another allergy besides the allergy that I have to alcohol. I have an allergy to pollen. I have hay fever. Had it all my life, you know. And when I get in the grass certain times of the year, you know, when the oak trees start, you know, throwing off pollen, my eyes start watering and my nose gets stuffed up, and if I get it on my skin, I get these big welts all over me. It's terribly uncomfortable, right? And so I kind of understand that an allergy has something that causes it and something that happens as a result of it, Okay, that's what basically happens when you have an allergy. But as I said, unlike my allergy to pollen, when I drink alcohol, I don't get welts. When I don't get watery eyes, I develop an internal reaction that I would never guess, right? I would never guess. And the reason that alcoholism is so difficult sometimes for people who are non-alcoholics to understand, because, you know, alcoholics don't care. We drink, we have an abnormal reaction, right? I develop this craving. My buddy who's a non-alcoholic, he doesn't have that craving, right? And that's not a problem for me. I just want to drink. You know what I mean? But the 9 who have a normal reaction, and that's what they estimate, about 1 in 10, less than 1 in 10, but about 1 in 10 has an abnormal reaction, right? And immediately the 9 who have the normal reaction start trying to figure out the 1 who has the abnormal reaction, right? And that's always been the case with me. Non-alcoholics are always trying to figure us out, aren't they, right? And they're always offering us tons of advice, aren't they, right, about what we should do, okay? And the reason that it's so difficult for the non-alcoholic to understand is it would be no different than if someone were colorblind. If someone's colorblind and I'm looking at that maroon-colored wall the same way they're looking, I assume that they're seeing the same thing that I'm seeing, okay, unless I knew that they were colorblind, okay? A lot of well-meaning people in my life assume that I had the same reaction to alcohol that they did, right? And so that's why non-alcoholics always say things like, just don't drink, right? Oh, God, if I had a dollar for every time I heard that from a non-alcoholic in my life, right? My father used to tell me that. And you know, my father, he was a good man. You know, he's still a good man. You know, he tried hard to help me, you know. But what he didn't realize is alcohol didn't do for him what it did for me, see? If it did for him what it did for me, he'd drink like I drink, right? But it doesn't. It has a different effect, and he's going to start talking about that on the bottom page. And often, like I said, this is why people misunderstand alcoholism, and this is oftentimes where there's a difficult time in treating alcoholism, okay? Because unless the people treating it are alcoholics, they don't understand a hell of a lot more about it than the people who have it, right? That's really true, okay? All right, bottom of the page. Though we work out our solution on a spiritual as well as altruistic plane, which means other-centered, he's going to say it twice, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached. And this has been true for me. And this is where treatment centers and detoxes are coming very handy. Okay? It says, as he then has a better chance of accepting what we have to offer. Next couple paragraphs down, two paragraphs down, where it says, we doctors. Everybody circle that word we. Okay? Now, notice here that he's not just speaking for himself. This is Silkworth again. He is not just speaking for himself here. He's now speaking for the medical fraternity. See, what they do, doctors, is they go to medical conventions and they talk about people like us, right? And they say, what do you do with those wacky alcoholics you get in Cleveland, you know? I don't know, you know, take two of these and good luck, you know, that kind of thing, right? It says, we doctors have realized for a long time, that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its applications presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, perhaps we are not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. What's he trying not to say? God, right? He's saying that we have realized for a long time that there has to be what he calls moral psychology, right? Moral psychology, a new approach to old ideas, right? That there has to be some form of something other than what we can do. If you go to a doctor, doctors work on empirical evidence, the 5 senses of the body, right? And if you go to a doctor, they're usually going to do one of 2 things. They're either going to cut it out of you, or they're going to give you a pill to fix it, right? And if they can't do that, there's really not a hell of a lot they can do for you, right? And he's making a great admission here, isn't he? He's saying, we realize that you alcoholics need something that we can't give you, right? And we realize you need something more than what our ultra-moderns, in 1939, they're ultra-modern standards, right? Right? And incidentally, when we get over into chapter 2, Dr. Jung's going to say the same thing about psychiatry that Silkworth says about medicine. that psychiatrists don't have an answer to our problem either, right? I had a friend back in California, Dr. Mark, and Dr. Mark, he does a lot of speaking. He's been sober a long time. And Dr. Mark's an ER doctor, and he's been sober, like I said, about 30 years now. And he sees alcoholism all the time, right? I mean, he says he probably sees more alcoholism in the ER than they see on the alcoholic ward, you know? And that's probably true, you know? We alcoholics, we love emergency rooms, don't we? God, I love them. I must love them. I always ended up there, you know? I must love them, you know? But he'll get guys that'll come in, women will come in, you know, gunshot wound, knife wound, you know? He says, I can fix that. You know, fell out of a car. He can fix that, you know, a lot of times. But if somebody comes in and says, listen, do you have a treatment for alcohol? Do you have a cure for alcoholism, right? They don't have a cure for alcoholism today any more than they had in 1939 when they wrote this book, right? We have a treatment today. That's the difference. We have a treatment today that they did not have before Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? All right, let's flip over to the next page. And here's where they're going to start talking about that 1-2 punch that I talked about. Step one, the problem. Step two, the solution, right? And they're going to start talking about the symptoms of alcoholism, what alcoholism looks like. It says, we believe, and this is the doctor again, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy. Let's stop right there. Chronic alcoholics, and that's me. See, I'm a chronic alcoholic. I'm not an acute alcoholic, right? I mean, I think I'm acute alcoholic, but I'm not an acute alcoholic, right? Right? I'm not a severe alcoholic. I'm not a mild alcoholic. I am a chronic alcoholic. Okay, what does that mean? It means it's never going away, and it's never going to get any better by any treatment that I can impose upon myself. I have it. Whether I'm drunk or sober, I have alcoholism. Okay? And I think there's some confusion about that, right? And our book's going to describe, when we get into the third chapter, some different types of drinkers. And I believe there's more than one type of alcoholic. Okay? I don't try to cause any controversy, but I believe that there's an acute alcoholic. The book calls him the hard drinker, right? The book says he may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him mentally and physically, but if he has a sufficiently strong reason, such as ill health, falling in love, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, he can stop or moderate, right? But that's not me, see? I'm a chronic alcoholic, right? And so I think that that's important as we go through here. The reason I mention that is because when they start talking about the effect of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics, okay, they're talking about the effect of alcohol on guys like me, okay? And that's why the book says again and again and again, when we start getting into the directions for taking the steps, if you're an alcoholic of our type, okay? I don't know if you're an alcoholic of their type, but I know I am, right? I know I am. It says, the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving, means it can't be understood, it's a phenomenon, is limited to this class, and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. It never occurs. See, I used to think non-alcoholics had great willpower, right? Anybody here ever thought that? You look at them, you watch them, and you go, my God, you know? They leave a half a glass of wine on the table. I thought, you know, they must be dying to do that, you know? But what I did not realize is because alcohol has a different effect on me, see, they don't have to have willpower. They get all they want every time they drink, right? You see, as Joe and Charlie used to say that, you know, alcoholics, the best way to describe it is that when I have a drink or two or three drinks, and when the non-alcoholic has two or three drinks, the effect that I get is, well, let's start with the non-alcoholic, okay? The non-alcoholic gets a slightly tipsy, relaxed, out-of-control feeling, right? And most of the time they don't like it. And I've talked to non-alcoholics about it. If you've never done that, I suggest you do it. It is fascinating, right? Talk to a non-alcoholic. Ask them what happens to them when they have two or three drinks, right? And they'll tell you, we start to feel a little out of control. And we don't like that feeling, Rob. Right? Now, that is not the effect I get when I have two or three drinks, right? I get a highly excited, euphoric, in-control feeling, right? You see, they're ready to go to bed, and I'm ready to go to South Beach, right? And therein lies the difference, right? You see, for them, alcohol is a depressant. For me, alcohol is a stimulant, okay? And I get a completely different reaction than they get, right? All right. It goes on to say, so that top couple sentences there is the first part of step one. I am powerless over alcohol. Why? Because I have a physical allergy. Now they're going to get the second part of step one. Step 1B, I call it. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form, right? Now, for me, in any form includes depressants. For me, in any form includes other chemicals that affect me from the neck up. That's just me. It says, once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. My life is now unmanageable. Step 1B. So, as I predicted, they are now going to follow that with my solution. Step 2. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. Everybody underline that. Oh, if love could have kept me sober. Boy, I tell you. I had lots of people begging and pleading me. I remember my mother coming and tears rolling down her face, pleading with me to stop drinking, right? And I looked her in the eye and I said, Mom, I'm going to stop for you, right? And I meant it. I meant it, you know? And 24 hours later, I forgot all about it, right? And I was drunk again. It goes on to say the message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. Means it's got to make sense. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. Right? Step 2, the idea of a power greater than myself restoring me to sanity. Right? Now, we talked about it a little bit last week. There's two of those musts that aren't in our book right there. Okay. All right, let's jump down to the bottom paragraph on that page. Okay. Here's where we start really getting into the crux of this, and we're going to go through this, and then we'll take a break here. But down at the bottom of this page, Silkworth starts to talk about why we drink. Okay? Why we drink. Why does the alcoholic drink? Right? He's going to outline his theory for us, right? And he's going to tell me here what the nature of my problem is, and he's going to tell me what my solution is. I didn't realize this for a long time, right? He tells me right here what my problem is and what my solution is. He says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Anybody here disagree with that? I didn't think so. All right. It says the sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, it is killing me, it is destroying my family and my life, right? They cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. We're coming back to that. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal. And that really is true, isn't it? Right? You know, the road to hell is not like a straight ski jump like this. It's just this slow progression down and around. And each step of the way, as you pass through those barriers and do those things that you said you'd never do, you make it normal, don't you? Right? That's what I did. Right? I'll never drink in the... Okay, well, now I'm drinking in the morning, but I'll never do this. And then you do that, and I'll never do that. Right? And you just go on and deeper into hell. And you make it normal, right? My alcoholic life seems normal to me, right? To everyone else, it looks like complete insanity, but to me, I make it normal, right? It goes on to say, they are restless, irritable, and discontented. And you can add the word shame, fear, guilt, remorse, self-pity, anxiety, resentment, right? And any other adjectives you want, okay? Unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks they see others taking with impunity, which means without punishment, right? So here I go with my non-alcoholic friend, and I here's the nature of my problem, and I didn't realize it. Before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I lived my life in a continual state in sobriety, when forced into abstinence, and that was the only time I was sober, when I was forced into abstinence, of restless, irritable, and discontent. Right? That's how I lived. That's how I lived before I started drinking, if I'm honest. Right? I never felt like I was one person. I always felt like I was two halves. Right? And I'll tell you, When I had that first drink at about age 12 or 13 years old, I got a sense of ease and comfort and peace and contentment and belonging that I had never known before. And I found my medicine, right? But the book says that I am restless, irritable, and discontent when sober, right? You see, so for me, what does that mean? That means my alcoholism starts where my drinking stops. You see, the biggest difference between me and the acute alcoholic is that he puts the plug in the jug and he's fine, right? He's fine. He can go on, and we've all known people like that, don't we, right? They have problems with their marriage or their job or whatever. My dad was like that. My dad was what most people call an alcoholic. He had a DUI in 1977. He had a bleeding ulcer as a result of his drinking. He went to the doctor. The doctor said, Bob, you got to stop that or it's going to kill you, right? He put the plug in the jug, never looked back, didn't need no sponsor, didn't need no steps, didn't need no AA, right? He's fine, right? But see, that doesn't work for a guy like me, right? I'm not an acute alcoholic, right? You see, when I'm forced into a state of abstinence, I get restless, irritable, and discontent, and it feels like I'm doing time, right? It feels like I'm doing time, right? It feels like there's this fuse that gets lit, and sometimes it's long, and sometimes it's short, but sooner or later, I'm going to drink. And the surest way that I know that this is a spiritual illness rather than just a physical, only a physical or mental one, is this, is that if you're in that state, if you've ever experienced that restlessness, irritability, and discontentedness, that sense that you're just not comfortable in your own skin, sober, if you've ever suffered from alcoholism sober, okay, you can go down to the hospital and they'll put you on an MRI, they'll run every test possible, and they'll tell you there's nothing wrong with you, right? But those of us who have lived through that, we know better, don't we, right? And I'll tell you, there were times when I was forced into a state of abstinence, and you don't want to be around me when I'm sober, right? You do not want to be around me when I'm forced into a state of abstinence because I get worse, not better, right? And all of a sudden I get these resentments and these fears and these anxieties, and I don't know why I feel that way. And all of a sudden I start feeling like I'm either going to kill you or kill me, and I'm not sure which, right? And the only thing that gives me any relief, the book says, is my solution. That sense of ease and comfort that I get from taking a few drinks, right? And I'll tell you, I got that feeling when I was 12 or 13 years old when I had my first drunk, even though I ended up in a blackout and ended up in the hospital with alcohol poisoning, right? And I drank that way progressively for many, many years, right? But the odd thing about alcoholism, you know, normal people would only throw up once, wouldn't they, right? Only once, right? But not me. See, I don't remember what alcohol does to me. All I remember is that sense of ease and comfort that I get from taking a few drinks, right? And that's what makes me different. And it doesn't make anything different, but for a little while I get a little bit of relief. It makes everything... You know what alcohol does for me, really? Is it makes things look better than they really are. It makes me feel better than I really am, right? Because my big fear really is that if you felt the way about me that I felt about me, you really wouldn't like me very much. All right, let's take a 5-minute break.